first story behind mansion walls. Drugs, beauty, lies.
This was the easy fastest money you could get.
And a body in a suitcase.
But I sure wouldn't want to buy a house that had a dead body hiding in it.
And later, hard work makes a family fortune.
I saw opportunities there and a chance for a fresh start.
Until greed makes a massacre.
Three persons had been murdered.
Hello! I just saw blood all over and blood all over the floor.
I'm Christopher Mason. In the world of the wealthy, good looks can be a ticket to success, but they can also be deceiving. Sometimes looks can kill. Beware the killer's smile. Go!
As the financial crisis sinks the country deeper into debt, some things keep on booming, like bankers' bonuses and surgically enhanced bus lines.
You have all this new technology available that can make people look better and feel better about themselves.
In 2011, $10 billion was spent on cosmetic surgery in the United States. Americans want to be beautiful. And they're prepared to pay for it.
Yeah.
Most don't expect it to cost their lives.
He's reacting. He's going to shock.
New York City. If you want to make it here, it helps to be easy on the eyes. Like Dean Faiello.
Dean was a very good-looking man. He attracted attention everywhere he went.
In the mid-80s, Dean's dream is to join the ranks of the Gay 500, an informal A-list of prominent gay men. The only flaw in his plan? All he's qualified to do is make cement.
He started out in construction after he dropped out of college. He complained that he was just so tired of working so hard for so little money.
So Dean trades his hammer for a laser. He trains as an electrologist.
He could make more money while working less hours and expending less energy if he got involved in the beauty business.
In the late 90s, Faiello works at a Soho skin clinic, reportedly patronized by Madonna and Drew Barrymore.
Okay, I'm gonna do it once.
Before starting his own practice, Skinovations.
It seemed like nothing was out of his reach if it involved a laser.
You're going to feel a slight tingling sensation, okay?
He was offering tattoo removal, removal of birthmarks, removal of different growths of the skin.
Dr. Roy Geronimus works as a dermatologist in Manhattan. He recalls first hearing Dean Faiello's name in the late 90s.
He was selling himself as an expert, as somebody who could provide great results with the technology that was available at that point in time.
It's a very quick and easy procedure. Okay.
Yeah. He was like a likable guy. You could see why people would like him. He had a good personality.
Retired investigator Brian Ford believes that charm was key to Faiello's success.
He was working out of a doctor's office in Gramercy Park. It was a beautiful building, and my understanding of the equipment that he was using was very expensive, like to the tune of like $100,000.
Meanwhile, across town, a very different story is playing out. In 1992, Maria Cruz moves to New York from the Philippines to make her mark.
Maria Cruz was just an ordinary little girl who really had a dream that she wanted to make a reality.
While Faiello relies on good looks and charm, Maria is climbing the ladder using hard work. In 1998, she completes an MBA and is planning a career in finance.
Maria epitomizes the American dream. An immigrant comes to this country, makes good, makes a good living, finds happiness, finds fulfillment. And it probably would have been very successful and very delightful. But instead, she met Dean Fiala.
But Maria doesn't cross paths with Dean yet. For now, he's busy courting the East Side set. He hires a receptionist with a French accent. The business is earning good money. When he's not working, Dean relaxes in the mansion he bought in Newark, once owned by the renowned opera singer Maria Jiritsa.
It was in an area of Newark that was being gentrified with these big old houses that were once owned and occupied by nothing but the wealthy. Madame Jiritsa was a very big opera star in her time, both in the United States and in Europe. So you can imagine it was a very, very nice house.
A very nice house for Dean's fabulous parties.
Dean was very much involved in the New York party scene. He always felt like he had to put on a show.
In Fiala's world of pumped-up glamour, beauty and social status go hand in hand. It's a male grooming merry-go-round where every imperfection is ironed out. But Dean has a problem no amount of primping can fix. His nose. He simply can't fill it fast enough.
Dean had a horrible problem with drugs. Used a lot of cocaine. One of his drugs of choice was a prescription drug that is a controlled substance.
Dean is addicted to a narcotic nasal spray with an active ingredient 5 times the strength of morphine. To get it, Fiala steals prescription pads from a former employer.
At first he got blank ones. Then he got ones that actually had all been signed, so all he had to do was fill in the information of the drug that he wanted.
Fiala is spending all his earnings on drugs and borrowing thousands from his devoted boyfriend, Greg. His hedonistic lifestyle is out of control.
Dean lived solely for the moment. That can be admirable until you take it as far as Dean did. There was nothing that would stand in the way of what he wanted to do, and consequences be damned.
But in October 1998, consequences catch up with Fiala. The former employer he stole prescriptions from goes to the police. Fiala has served 3 years probation and a mandatory 6 weeks in rehab. And now, he has another problem, debt. Fiala is mooching more and more from his lover, Greg.
Greg put out a lot of money when Dean had his problems with law enforcement and his legal bills were mounting up. And I remember hearing Greg saying something to the effect of Dean owed him about $80,000.
How was that? Yeah? Okay, we can do about 4 more. Okay.
Luckily, Fiala's business is expanding. His client base is still strong. But there's another problem. He's being watched.
A couple of agencies started investigating Dean Fiala. They even sent undercover agents in as patients. A couple of investigative reporters start doing investigation of their own to see what they could find out about Dean Fiala.
By 2002, the Attorney General's office, the New York Post, and local TV news are all staking out Fiala's office. Why is such intense scrutiny being focused on him? Is it just the drugs? Or is there something else? What terrible secret could Dean Fiala be hiding?
And the guy told him, take that woman to the emergency room immediately. She has to go.
New York in 2002. It's the start of a new century and a new frontier in cosmetic perfection. As the rest of the world grows older, In Manhattan high society, time stands still. For the right price, it even goes backwards. Top cosmetic surgeons are making a killing and being worshipped like gods. Dean Fiello wants a piece of the action.
I know for a fact he was telling patients that he was a physician. He would introduce himself as Dr. Fiello.
Self-described Dr. Dean Fiello claims his laser can fix almost any skin condition.
Okay, great.
But the results aren't quite meeting expectations.
I began to see a number of his patients coming into my office for a second opinion following complications that had occurred as a result of his treatments. I was seeing excessive scarring. They were sometimes disfiguring and oftentimes painful as well.
Respected Manhattan dermatologist Dr. Roy Geronimus becomes suspicious. Surely no doctor would botch procedures this badly.
It was such a concern that I began to seek out who this person was. I had called New York State. I had searched online to see if, in fact, he was a physician and where he came from, and I couldn't find his name anywhere. I found that he had no qualifications. He was not licensed in the state of New York. He was not a physician. He was a fraud.
Yet Fiello is routinely diagnosing illnesses, injecting patients with anesthetic, and calling himself a doctor. In 2002, he is convicted of practicing medicine without a license. He spends $7,500 on an attorney and another $5,000 to post bond. As usual, his boyfriend Greg picks up the bill.
You would think that would be enough to teach him a lesson, that there's some things you just can't get away with. But no, Dean didn't learn that lesson. He needed money for his drugs. And the only way he could make a lot of money to pay his bills and buy his drugs was to practice medicine. And so he continued doing it.
Fiello is over $500,000 in debt. But it doesn't stop him from offering a large sum of money to rent an old friend's Manhattan apartment, where he sets up a makeshift clinic in early 2003. One of his patients is a young investment banker named Maria Cruz.
Maria Cruz was a remarkable woman, determined, ambitious, driven. She was born in the Philippines, but she realized that where she really wanted to be was New York, because that is where finance vibrated and moved the whole world.
These days, Maria works at Barclays Capital as a senior credit analyst and brings home a six-figure salary. But she chooses to live in a humble apartment on the Upper West Side.
She was a generous woman. When her family came to visit from the Philippines, she'd spend a fortune on tours and dinners and events and plays.
Maria is 35, but looks 10 years younger. What need could she have for cosmetic surgery?
Maria had a problem with this growth on her tongue called black hairy tongue. The treatment was monotonous and a bit painful because it involved scraping of the tongue. So she looked online to try to find a better way to deal with her problem. And that's when she found Dean Fiello.
In the beating heart of the Big Apple, two lives are about to intersect, like millions of others do every day. No one notices the dark clouds amassing. Least of all, Maria Cruz.
Dean told her,
"Open up for me.
I can take it away with a laser."
"Okay, thank you. Very easy procedure, okay?"
"Okay."
And he said, "It wouldn't hurt.
So I just want you to relax, okay?"
She believed what he said. She took everything that he said about himself at face value.
"Okay, very simple. See it all the time."
Drawn in by Fiello's killer smile, Maria places her life in his hands.
"Okay,
great.
month later, Dean's beloved mansion is on the market. But a strange odor is lurking around the house, and it needs a few cosmetic repairs. Dean's boyfriend Greg drops by to lend a hand.
Greg walked out to the carriage house and found Dean mixing up a batch of cement.
Hey, Dean, what are you doing?
Will you get out of here?
And Dean just chased him away.
Go!
It struck Greg as odd, but just how odd it was didn't strike him till months later.
After selling the mansion, Greg and Dean agree to separate. And Fiello takes advantage of his freedom. In September 2003, he flies to Costa Rica.
He went to a nice resort and demanded the finest room in the place. Dean always had to have the best.
Fiello is living it up in a $500 a night suite, using the fortune he got for his mansion. But for the family of Maria Cruz, times aren't so good. She's missing. No one's seen her since April, when she went to an appointment at Dean Fiello's clinic.
It's a horrible place to be, not knowing what happened to your loved one. Once you know what happened, you can deal with it. But until you know, you're just in a limbo of torture and pain.
By fall of 2003, New York police have been looking for Maria for 6 months. Then they get their first big lead.
I get a call from Joe DeLaRocca up in Midtown North Precinct. And he told me he had a missing persons case. He told me that Maria Cruz.
Former investigator Brian Ford recalls the connection that brought him into the case.
He said, I have some emails from her and Dean Fiello. She says, what do you know about Dean? I said, well, I locked him up twice for practice in medicine. He asked me, was he violent? And I said, not to my knowledge, but, you know, what do I know? I mean, people could be, you know, happy-go-lucky women and be violent the next. I mean, it's just such human nature.
The emails revealed Maria had been receiving treatments from Fiello. He tells Maria he will pick up lidocaine and syringes before her April 13th appointment.
Lidocaine is like Novocaine. It's the type of thing you get when you're having a skin procedure and the doctor's numbing your skin. So it's generally a very safe anesthetic. You can have toxicity, where if you're given too much, that can lead to a problem with the heart.
Investigators want to talk to Fiello, but they don't know where he is. So they reach out to his ex-boyfriend, Greg. For years, Greg had been bailing Dean out of trouble, but not anymore.
We're asking him some questions, you know, like, I says, give us something that you know, you found strange during that whole time.
Greg recalls an unusual smell shrouding Fiello's mansion in the weeks before it was sold.
Terrible odor. So now that peaked our interest. What did it smell like? He says, I don't know. It just smelled terrible, like a dead cat. Something just terrible.
Then Greg remembers something even stranger. Fiello's mysterious cement-laying project in the garage. To investigators, it's reason enough to obtain a search warrant. Does the secret of Maria Cruz's disappearance lie somewhere beneath the Newark mansion?
She was just going to the doctor. Dean didn't think he was putting her life in danger when he injected her tongue with lidocaine. Unfortunately, not being a doctor, he was not aware of the sensitivity of lidocaine. So when he injected a little too much lidocaine into her tongue, she started reacting.
She's reacting. She's going to shock.
What was
administered? Lidocaine. I don't know.
He called and talked to an emergency medical physician, and the guy told him, take that woman to the emergency room immediately.
Okay, I'll get to her.
Dean didn't do a thing. Maria Cruz died on the table. Then, to make matters worse, Dean took her little 90-pound body and stuck it in a suitcase. He threw it in the back of his SUV and drove Maria Cruz's body to his Victorian mansion in Newark.
On January 18th, 2004, police dig up the concrete floor of Fiala's garage.
As soon as we broke the concrete, we pulled away some, and you could, the smell came out, and we knew, you know, we think we found it. It was a sad sight when, you know, there was no reason for this.
The American dream that brought Maria Cruz to these shores dies with her.
This is what I would call an accidental murder. That makes it sound like, you know, it wasn't all that bad, but it really was. Because beneath the accident, there was Dean's narcissism. It led him to be involved in that situation, and then it led him to stand by and gamble with a woman's life, and she lost that bet. And she died on his table because he did not go for help, because he didn't want to get in trouble.
Author Diane Fanning believes Fiala considered his liberty to be worth more than Maria's life.
Fiala was always one for taking the easy way. It was much easier to practice medicine without a license than to go to medical school and get one. It was much easier to gamble that Maria Cruz would pull out of her convulsions and be okay than to take her to the emergency room where he knew he'd be identified and be in trouble, because one of the conditions of his bail was that he not practice medicine anywhere, anytime, with anyone.
It's not difficult for detectives to trace Fiala to his beachside retreat in Costa Rica. He's using his own credit card, introducing himself as a doctor from New York, and hosting lavish parties. When police arrive to arrest him in February 2004, they find him drinking a beer in the swimming pool. Hardly the picture of a man racked with guilt for his crimes.
Fiala spends 15 months in a Costa Rican jail before being extradited to face justice in New York. On October 16th, 2005, he pleads guilty to first-degree assault and receives a 20-year sentence. He'll be eligible for parole in 2022.
Dean thought that people were his way to make money, and he didn't care if they were at risk. In fact, he didn't think about it. He figured he'd just do it, everything would be fine. Dean Fiala was dangerous because he knew no limits. He relentlessly went after what he wanted, without any regard for the consequences.
Sydney, Australia. A prosperous city on a glittering harbor. And a booming economy where wealth seems within anyone's reach. Many of the immigrants who start a new life here aspire to building a family fortune. But not all their dreams will be fulfilled. And some are destroyed in an instant.
Face emergency.
Someone has shot my parents. Please come. Someone has shot my parents. I think they're all breathing down on the floor. They don't know me.
They're both being shot, have they?
I don't know this motherfucker.
All right, guys, camera. Ready? Go.
Teddy Gonzalez, his wife Loiva, and their two children, Seth and Claudine, came to Australia from the Philippines in 1991.
They saw opportunities there and a chance for a fresh start, and that's what they did. They moved to Sydney.
And the Gonzalez family needs a fresh start. The year before, their hometown of Baguio is devastated by an earthquake. The quake destroys the family business, a grand hotel called the Queen Victoria. The family escapes, except for Seth, just 9 years old at the time.
There was a beam that fell and pinned his leg. His leg was quite badly damaged.
His father, Teddy, heroically comes to Seth's rescue.
Seth was buried under the rubble, and Teddy literally had to crawl through the rubble to rescue his son.
The experience would forge a unique bond between father and son.
So obviously it made quite an impact on him.
And Seth hopes the bond with his father will only grow stronger over the years. He dreams that one day he'll own a large boat and take his dad out fishing with Seth's own son on his knee. But that day will never come.
Trained as a lawyer, Teddy Gonzalez opens his own legal practice in Sydney. As business grows, the family moves up in the world, buying a new house in Sydney's affluent northern suburbs.
And they enjoy the luxuries, you know, like new cars, and Lova was particularly fond of jewellery, so Teddy lavished gifts on her. The kids as well, I mean, Seth was given a car. Teddy and Lova gave the kids certainly more than what Teddy and Lova had growing up.
Both of their children had lots of opportunities with good schools and university educations, and they put a lot of focus onto their education.
To Detective Inspector Mick Sheehy, it's a classic example of an immigrant family laying a foundation of wealth for the next generation.
They're very family-focused people. Their primary concern was that their children received good education, ultimately received good jobs.
Seth is following in his father's footsteps, pursuing a pre-law degree in college. His parents have high expectations.
How's this, Teddy?
They want him to eventually take over the family firm.
Need help?
I think there was a lot of pressure, not just on Seth, but on Claudine as well. And it probably came from a good place as far as the parents were concerned, because they wanted them to have financial stability and to be able to stand on their own two feet.
On July 9th, 2001, it's Claudine's 18th birthday. So the family goes out for a special dinner.
They went out to a Japanese restaurant in the city, and by all accounts, it was a great night. So everything was very, very happy families that night.
But the very next day, the Gonzalez family's peaceful life of plenty will be destroyed. In one frenzied night of hate, greed, and unimaginable violence.
Face emergency. I saw the man lying on his back, and I just saw blood all over him, blood all over the floor.
July 10th, 2001. In the affluent northern suburbs of Sydney, Australia, Claudine Gonzalez is studying alone in the family mansion. It's 4:30 p.m. on the day after her 18th birthday. She has no idea it will be her last.
She was the first person to be killed.
Help me!
Her injury was from blunt trauma to the head.
An hour later, Loiva Gonzalez returns home.
Loiva, the mother, had left the workplace and had gone and done some shopping.
Claudine!
And would have returned home approximately an hour after Claudine had been murdered.
Then, at about 7 p.m., Teddy walks through the front door.
Hello?
midnight, 20-year-old Seth Gonzalez arrives at the house.
Papa! 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 No!
A neighbor hears his screams and runs to his aid.
Help! Someone's killed my father!
Then calls police.
Police emergency. What's happened there?
I saw the man lying on his back and I just saw blood all over him, blood all over the floor.
Seth says he came home to find his whole family slaughtered.
Someone's killed my father! Help! Help! Papa!
In a phone call to police, he sounds understandably distressed.
Police service, what is your emergency?
Please come, someone has shot my family!
Just calm down.
Someone's killed my family! They're on the floor. They're not breathing. What do I do?
Inspector Mick Sheehy is the first homicide detective on the scene.
I was informed that Seth Gonzalez had located the bodies. Seth Gonzalez, in this case, had indicated he had chased an offender or offenders from the scene.
By the time police arrive, there's no sign of the alleged attackers. Inside the house, they find a scene of horror.
They had all died from multiple stab wounds, in excess of 20 stab wounds to each person. There was two knives missing from a knife block which was in the kitchen of the premises.
As the forensic investigation continues, something curious emerges.
What became particularly relevant was the body temperatures and therefore establishing the times which each of the deceased had been murdered. And it was quite apparent that each of them had been murdered at different times throughout the evening.
The conclusion was that the crimes had been planned and that the killer had shown a degree of being very comfortable within the house because he waited a period of time between killing Claudine, then Loiva, then Teddy.
Who would be so desperate to kill this family that they'd lie in wait for hours to pick them off, one by one? In one of the rooms, the killer leaves what might be a clue to his motive.
There was some graffiti written on one of the walls within the kitchen in blue spray paint, which could give the impression of a race-motivated crime.
Is the racist scrawl a warning to Seth, the sole survivor?
This electronic interview between Detective Senior Constable Sheehy.
In the following weeks, detectives conduct in-depth interviews with Seth.
My name is Seth Gonzalez.
Trying to establish if his family had any enemies.
A lot of our investigations early were around the business dealings of Teddy Gonzalez. Being a solicitor may have created some potential motive, some disputes.
Seth even agrees to a reenactment for police of the night he discovered the bodies. In the hallway, Seth describes finding his father, Teddy.
I ran to him, I kneeled down, and then I was screaming my father's name, and I was screaming, Papa. I held his head, and was trying to wake him up, and...
But Seth can't save his dad.
I think I remember seeing my father's eyes were half open, and I closed his eyes. I fell back on the floor.
To the media and others following the case, Seth's composure in the wake of the tragedy is remarkable. He submits to police questioning, fronts press conferences, and delivers the eulogy at his family's funeral.
20-year-old Seth, who discovered the bodies, paid an emotional tribute to his dad.
Besides being my hero and role model, he was my mentor.
Many mourners are moved by the heartfelt homage. Then Seth closes his eyes, clears his throat, and softly croons an a cappella rendition of One Sweet Day by Mariah Carey and Boys to Men. And a rather different emotion ripples through the congregation.
You could have heard a pin drop. I don't think singing is exceptionally unusual at a funeral, but in that context, and as the sole surviving son who his family had been viciously wiped out. I think people thought, how could he do it?
To say that was unusual would be an understatement. I've certainly never seen anything like that before, and certainly family members were taken aback.
Also unusual in the months after the murders is Seth's apparent desire to speed up the process of accessing his family's estate.
He quite quickly went about selling his mother's jewellery, selling the motor vehicles. He sent letters to relatives over in the Philippines to get access to the estate over there. He was trying to get as much wealth as he possibly could.
Meanwhile, one of Seth's relatives has a secret that's eating her up inside. It's Seth's aunt, and what she tells police will change the course of the investigation. Early on the evening of the murders, she had visited the Gonzalez mansion and saw Seth's car in the driveway. Detectives are starting to wonder if the tears of Seth Gonzalez are real.
Lying was just a part of who he was.
In Sydney, Australia, a wealthy Asian family is viciously attacked and killed. Father, mother, daughter, all brutally stabbed over 20 times. Was it a race-motivated hate crime? Or something far more sinister?
Someone has shot my parents. I think they're all breathing down on the floor.
What suburb are you in?
They're not breathing. What do I do?
What suburb are you in?
North Ryde.
North Ryde.
July 10, 2001. A 20-year-old boy, the only survivor of a family massacre in the leafy, affluent northern suburbs of Sydney.
20-year-old Seth Gonzalez claims he discovered the bodies of his family and chased away the attacker. But new evidence from his aunt put Seth's vehicle at the scene during the time the murders were committed. And the police investigation is untangling a web of lies that cast suspicion over Seth.
For Seth, lying was just a part of who he was. It was deeply ingrained. He told people that he had some sort of major contract coming up with a cosmetic company, that he was a personal trainer. What he wanted to do, essentially, I think, is that he wanted to become famous. He wanted to get into music production. He held a few kind of events himself at nightclubs. So I think that's where he was heading, certainly not in the direction of becoming a doctor or a lawyer, as his family wanted him to do.
What are you doing? I'm doing my work.
Seth was not really performing to the standards his parents had required. And it created a lot of tensions within the family, but also some competition between the two siblings. Claudine was getting very good school marks and was sort of outshining her older brother, and he took offence to that somewhat.
Just prior to the murders, Seth's parents had told him if he didn't improve his grades, they'd cut his allowance and confiscate his car.
Most kids in that position would either study harder or catch the bus. But for little Seth, who feels entitled to privilege, neither of those options seems appealing. Why bother trying to make it when you can just fake it?
He was falsifying his university records to try to keep up the standards that his parents wanted him to achieve.
In reality, Seth's flunking out of college and facing expulsion. Facts his parents would soon have learned had they not been murdered.
His grades were due in a matter of days. They would be posted to the home. The parents would find out.
Journalist Carl Lawrence has been face to face with Seth Gonzalez and found him to be an enigmatic figure.
He was very polite. He was very meek and mild and, you know, pulled out a chair for you. He was quite gentlemanly. And when he spoke, though, he really, really considered what he was saying. Every word, you could see his mind ticking over and his eyes were very, very hard to read. He didn't have expressions per se.
6 months
after the murders, police confront Seth about his aunt's sighting of his car.
Are you aware of her attending the house at that time?
I don't know. I just found out that...
In an earlier statement, Seth had admitted visiting the house, but said he parked for just a few minutes, then left to meet a friend.
His version put the car in the garage only for a very short period of time when he says he was sitting in it, made a number of telephone calls and then drove away.
But his aunt had looked into the car and Seth wasn't in it.
She was clearly able to establish he was not in the car at that particular time.
Seth's life has been exposed. The next day, he admits he has a dark secret to confess.
He provided a version of his movements was that he had caught a taxi from near the house to Chatswood, where he spent some time with a prostitute, and then returned home, picked up his car and went out with his friend.
Seth comes from a strict Catholic background and claims he only lied in the first place to hide his shame about visiting a brothel. Later, he provides proof of what he says is his real alibi.
He had approached a taxi driver to provide a statement to him, and a taxi driver actually wrote a statement for him to say he'd picked him up on that particular evening.
Surveillance after the murders confirms Seth does regularly see a prostitute. But then, police investigate further.
The taxi driver told us that it was a false statement he had provided. The woman who worked in the brothel at the time was actually not working the week that Seth had nominated being over at that area.
Overwhelming suspicion now hangs over Seth, but police have no smoking gun to tie him to the murders. Until forensics produce an analysis of the clothing Seth wore that fatal night.
Seth, at no time, said he was aware of the graffiti that was painted on the wall. And yet, a thorough forensic examination of his clothing established that there was a small droplet of blue paint on his sleeve, and that was matched forensically to the paint that was on the wall.
Finally, the police investigation has trapped the killer. The mysterious attacker is Seth himself.
Someone has shot my parents. I think they're all breathing down on the floor.
The whole image portrayed by Seth Gonzalez was all lies.
Even Seth's guided tour, where he calmly reenacted the discovery of the bodies, was pure fiction.
I remember seeing my father's eyes were half open.
Anybody home? Oh! Oh! Oh!
And I closed his eyes. I went for my mother. Her body was in an awkward position here. I went towards my sister's room.
Seth is charged with the murders of his sister, mother, and father. The father who saved Seth's life when he was just 9 years old. It's left to the public to wonder, what could have driven this baby-faced boy to commit such horrific acts?
greed was definitely part of it. But I think also what Seth stood to gain is probably in his mind some freedom.
He had convinced friends that he was a very wealthy young man. He had portrayed that he had certain modelling contracts overseas, that he was a doctor, that he was a lawyer. Ultimately, his family was standing in the way in a life he wanted to portray and access to the inheritance that he thought he would obtain.
On Seth's computer, there is evidence that he'd researched other methods of murder in the weeks before his family died.
It showed a series of attempts over a sustained period of time of research on how to kill someone and specific attempts to obtain poisonous seeds that essentially you could order over the internet and feed someone to kill them. And Seth originally tried to say that he had not conducted the searches that his father had because his father was planting a back garden and maybe wanted to not plant poisonous seeds.
In April 2004, Seth Gonzalez goes to trial in Sydney. He's found guilty of 3 counts of murder and sentenced to 3 life sentences without parole. He still maintains his innocence.
I don't think Seth will ever admit to his role in this crime. I think Seth still portrays himself as being a victim. I think he's delusional.
The first rule of fame and fortune is never believe your own hype. It's a lesson Seth Gonzalez and Dean Fiello would do well to learn. Seth Gonzalez massacred his family so he could keep his car and pursue a fantasy of wealth. While Dean Fiello played doctor till death broke up the party. They traded in lies and hid their deadly greed with a killer's smile. Till next we meet behind mansion walls, I'm Christopher Mason.